Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from Utah State University, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source, and iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education.
This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Today we're talking about recreation and water on the program. In our first case, dams versus kayakers. Water is a public resource, and dams often just borrow it while they're generating power. But while that water is impounded in reservoirs or forced into pipelines, it's temporarily not available in the river for boating. At the diversion dam on the Weber River, just a few miles up the canyon from the town of Ogden, the water just disappears. There's a wide, swollen reservoir backed up behind the dam, but downstream, there's just a lot of exposed rocks with a trickle of water running between, because most of the water is in a concrete pipe.
Because a hydropower plant is essentially a two-step process where you divert the water into a pipe, and in the pipe, you generate head, and the head is what drives the turbine. If it's just in the river, you don't have any pressure. You're not generating hydrostatic or head pressure in order to drive the turbine.
I'm with Charlie Vincent. He's an engineer, but that's not why he's here. He's here because he's a boater, a kayaker specifically, and a volunteer with American Whitewater, a nonprofit organization that protects rivers for a variety of reasons, one of which is recreation.
Someplace right in here is where you'd carry your boat down and put in, and obviously there'd have to be more water, and then the activity starts right at the top of this bend.
American Whitewater works to provide something called recreational releases on dammed rivers like the Weber. A recreational release means that the dam doesn't siphon off the river to make power. The water is released from the gates and flows back into the river in its natural channel. Every 30 years or so, privately owned hydropower projects like the one PacifiCorp operates on the Weber have to reapply for their operating license from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. This relicensing process is a window of opportunity for groups like American Whitewater to come to the table as stakeholders in the river.
Water in a river is a public resource. That's undeniable. And everybody wants to use that water for their own benefit. The relicensing process under the Federal Power Act gives everyone theoretically an equal share. I don't know if it's truly equal, but I mean that is the goal. To let every stakeholder, in a balancing process, to have everyone's needs met.
Charlie Vincent was instrumental in restoring recreational flows to the Bear River through southeastern Idaho. Representing American Whitewater, he participated in a relicensing process that took over a decade. In 2008, the new license for the dam at Grace, Idaho, called for 16 recreational releases annually.
I guess the more people that are interested in the sport and the place where it happens, the more it perpetuates the opportunity for others to do it and to share in it. I mean, publicity is a good thing. You know, a lot more people do the Bear now than used to do it. So, yeah, it's a giving back to the community.
Vincent has a kid now, and he doesn't kayak as much as he used to through these temporarily inundated sections of river he's worked on. But he's still at it when it comes to advocating for good boating, as well as protection for native fish like the Bonneville cutthroat trout.
I mean, the Weber's kind of always, I remember a decade or more ago looking to see when the relicensing of this came up, and it was so far in the future.
The license expires in a few years, so the process starts now for Charlie Vincent. That's why we're here today, staring at the boulders in the low-flowing river. Vincent has no trouble imagining the whitewater that could be flowing through here. He can describe every move he would make in his kayak to pick his way through the rocks and currents of this exhilarating stretch of the Weber River. Charlie Vincent's work on the Bear River opened up recreational releases through a stretch called the Black Canyon. It's this tight basalt canyon just downstream from Grace, Idaho, that turns into a world-class kayak run a few times a year during the releases. There's a whitewater festival every year at Black Canyon during one of the initial releases. Kayakers come from all around the country to race through the temporary rapids. When I first heard about the recreational releases at Black Canyon from some of my friends who were headed to the festival, I had a lot of questions. Why can you only run it 9 times a year? How can kayakers force a hydropower company to basically turn off a dam? How important can fun be when it comes to negotiating the uses of a river? This is what led me to Charlie Vincent, who explained a lot to me about how kayakers end up at dam relicensing meetings. But I knew I needed to ask the power company what they were thinking, so I called them up.
You are now joining the meeting.
Hi, thank you. I'm Eve Davies. I am the principal scientist for Hydro Resources here for PacifiCorp. I work mostly for the Hydro Resource Department, handling a lot of the environmental issues.
My name is Dave Eskelson. I'm company spokesman for Rocky Mountain Power. Rocky Mountain Power is a division of PacifiCorp, and PacifiCorp provides electric service to 1.8 million customers in 6 western states.
It's a long road to get to how whitewater recreation figures into the equation. Hydropower only accounts for 6% of the electricity generated by Rocky Mountain Power, so we're talking about maybe the smallest stake on the smallest source of power in the state. But it wasn't always that way.
Salt Lake City was the 5th city in the world to get Central Station electric lighting in 1881. And much of those early electric resources were hydroelectric.
Mill Creek, Big Cottonwood Creek, and several other, you know, smaller facilities all had some of the earliest hydroelectric generation. And 2 of those stations are still working right now, which is really supremely interesting. They're cool old facilities that operate right now. They're both built in the 1890s, both still function today.
And that must be a very small amount of power that they're generating.
It is by today's standards. At the standards of the time, it was major sources of generation. Many of those early plants were built to serve mining interests, particularly the gold and silver mining in Park City and the Tintic districts. And it was from that genesis in the mining industry that cities and towns then became interested in using electricity for street lighting and for streetcars.
And that was basically the entire load for quite a bit of time. Well, probably a couple decades anyway. There weren't any appliances to plug in. There were light bulbs and street lights and the trolley. So that was the vast majority of what was on the grid, of what was electrified.
Obviously, our need for and use of electricity grew exponentially throughout the 20th century, and so did the population. Utah quickly outgrew what the local creeks could provide with hydroelectricity.
And that's when the company began to invest in coal plants, but also the company, starting about 1909, began developing hydroelectric plants on the Bear River. And for many years, that was one of the major sources of electricity for Utah, southeastern Idaho, and western Wyoming.
So there's a brief history of hydroelectricity in Utah. Obviously, things changed a lot in the 60s and 70s with developments in coal and natural gas. There's not enough water in arid Utah to meet the electrical needs of modern life. But there are still dams on the Bear and the Weber Rivers, and they are still producing power. There are technical supply and demand reasons as to why Rocky Mountain Power keeps these small hydropower projects around, but a lot of them have outlived their use. Sometimes when the relicensing period comes up, the company decides to decommission or remove a dam if they can't justify its existence. Knowing that some of the dams were placed on Utah rivers when Grover Cleveland was president, it's not surprising that things have changed in water and energy policy. It's changed a lot even since the 1970s when some of the more modern hydropower projects were built. There wasn't a Clean Water Act, there wasn't a Federal Environmental Protection Agency until 1970, and the Endangered Species Act didn't come around until 1973. To get back to recreation, whitewater kayaking wasn't really a thing back then, let alone a priority. A watershed moment came in 1986. Dave Eskelson explains.
There was a law that was passed in 1986 called the Electric Consumers Protection Act. And that was kind of a later act in a series of mostly federal initiatives that really changed and focused the electric utility's emphasis on how it does business. And I think for much of our history, you know, up into the 1970s, 1980s, electric power was considered a primary usage of hydroelectric dams on the river. But that 1986 law also put recreational and wildlife habitat, including fish habitat, on equal footing with those concerns, and required electric utilities in their operations to account for all of those. They're sometimes competing uses, but to try to achieve a balance.
Now we're getting somewhere. Now I can finally ask a power company representative why on earth they're willing to spill water for a kayaking festival.
Because that's the law. And we understand a lot more about the relationship between rivers and the environment than we did in the 1930s, when so many of the big dams were built, and particularly, you know, the 1890s and early 1900s, when a lot of these projects went in. They were mostly focused at that time on irrigation, flood control, generation of hydropower. So as we have learned more about not only power production, but also protecting our environment, we are certainly willing to do more things to try to, again, achieve that balance between the various uses that our water resources have for both practical kinds of considerations, but also recreation as well.
Because times have changed and government regulation has kept up with changing values, priorities, and attitudes of the American people. That's the answer. But it's still someone's job to sit everyone down and figure out how to share the river. Obviously, not everyone gets what they want out of these negotiations. The relicensing process is often contentious, it's often litigious, but sometimes it works out, like on the Bear River. There were originally four projects going up for relicensing at the same time. Before they even really got started, Rocky Mountain Power decided to remove one of them, the Cove facility. Because like I mentioned earlier, sometimes they can't really justify these small projects, especially since mitigation for things like fish habitat can cost more money than a dam brings in. The Bear River negotiations have a happy ending. Pretty much everyone got what they wanted. Here's Eve Davies.
We worked really hard to craft an agreement when we're talking about those three facilities on the Bear that we relicensed in 2003. It was unanimously signed by all of the parties, a settlement agreement that basically said, here's what we're going to do to minimize the impact of our facilities on the river. And everyone agreed that our first order of business was to try and improve things for the Bonneville cutthroat trout. And, of course, that includes all the other aquatic species along with it. So we have reduced our generation flows and increased the flows that are in the river all the time, not just for recreation, but for the fish. And then on top of that, we also agreed that we needed to provide these recreational releases, these additional flows, for whitewater enthusiasts so they could get into the Black Canyon. Because before that, the only time folks were in the Black Canyon was when there was so much water that there was enough water to run the Black Canyon and our pipe was still full at the same time, so we were running the hydroelectric plant. So now we turn the hydroelectric generation off. We put the water in the canyon to create these recreational releases.
I think in Black Canyon we came up with something that is really remarkable in that I think we were able to satisfy everybody's concerns and come up with something that was not only workable but actually a huge benefit to all concerned.
A little side note, to be perfectly transparent and because it's kind of adorable. While working on the Bear River relicensing agreement, Eve Davies spent a lot of time in meetings with various stakeholders, including a certain volunteer from American Whitewater named Charlie Vincent. Eve jokes that the process was so collaborative that she and Charlie got married and they had a baby after it was all said and done. That was over 10 years ago. The Bear River relicensing went smoothly, but Eve Davies and PacifiCorps have even higher hopes for the Weber River process. The license expires in 2020, and they're already working on something called the pre-application document, which outlines the project for all potential stakeholders. Dave Eskelson remembers the last time the Weber went through this process in 1990.
I'm just old enough that I am seeing the licensing process for the Weber plant starting over again. When I was a newspaper reporter in the 1980s, that process was beginning, and it made quite a bit of news headlines just in the field of focus that I was in as a newspaper reporter, and that relicensing process was going on when I left the news business and went to work for the power company.
It's important to remember that boating is fun. Whitewater is exciting. Rivers are beautiful. It's hard to measure our emotional attachment to water, but in some ways, even a corporation like Rocky Mountain Power takes it into consideration.
Both Dave and I recreate on the water. I haven't been down Black Canyon, so I probably won't anytime soon. I won't speak for Dave on that. But we both enjoy water recreation. So, you know, I think everybody has a vested stake sort of all throughout this process, like we've kept talking about, as water is a public resource. So.
I think when you talk about, when you mentioned the importance of recreation, I would agree, and I think the company agrees, that recreation is important.
How important is it? It's hard to say. There's not really a metric for it unless you count the acre feet of water released 9 times a year at Black Canyon, for instance. Is it a lot? Is it enough? For some boaters, it is. For some, it isn't. Eve Davies encourages people to get involved in the process, to come to relicensing meetings for the Weber River if they want to have a say in how the river gets used. Charlie Vincent will be there, for sure.
How avid of a boater are you now?
It'll be 3 years this summer that I haven't been in my boat.
Oh, man.
Bigger problem for my boating career is that I have chosen to try to be a better parent. And I have a 4.5-year-old. And I guess I'm in too deep on the relicensing stuff, so it's hard to walk away now.
Well, it's a sacrifice in itself, you know? For other people, right?
It doesn't feel like a sacrifice. It's a way that I can contribute to a sport and to people that I really care about. You know, this is a really important, it's taught me a lot about myself and gotten me to a lot of beautiful places. And it's, you know, good to be able to share that with others.
Next up, don't put your feet down. The source's Ross Chambliss has the exciting legal drama of stream access in Utah. Stay tuned.
Fifty years ago, composer Bruce Adolph was given a walking, talking, flying birthday present, a green Panama parrot, and the two have been together now for half a century. On the occasion of his 60th birthday, Bruce tells us about his friendship with a very special, very musical bird. On the next Performance Today from APM.
Friday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from Utah State University, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source, and iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education.
This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Sometimes when water crosses invisible political lines, tempers and lawsuits ensue. Currently in Utah, recreationalists are forbidden from walking on stream beds where public streams run across private lands. Some say this basically limits the public's right to use nearly half of all Utah's rivers and streams. A battle has been smoldering in Utah's capital and courts for several years now. Ross Chambliss has the story.
This story began when Kevin and Jody Knatzer dragged their rubber raft into the Weber River at a public access point in June of 2000. As they drifted down the river, they crossed over a parcel of private property belonging to two ranchers, Wayne and Dwayne Johnson. The Knatzers may or may not have known this. Property lines are often invisible, especially when they cross under a stream. As Kevin and Jody paddled, their raft occasionally touched the rocky riverbed and the shoreline. At one point, Kevin got out of the raft and walked across the private riverbed over to the shore to fish. When he encountered fencing strung across the river by the Johnsons, he shifted it a little to get by, as he had done several times before. At some point, the Johnsons came out and ordered the Knatzers off the river. They told them to drag the raft out and leave, but the Knatzers refused. Kevin kept fishing, and they kept floating down the river. Later, when they exited downstream at another public access point, a Morgan County deputy sheriff was waiting for them. He cited them for criminal trespass. The Knatzers appealed, and eventually state prosecutors dropped the charge, finding, quote, uncertainty regarding the Knatzers' status as trespassers. Afterward, the Knatzers filed a civil action. In summer of 2008, the Utah Supreme Court agreed that touching the stream bed is, quote, reasonably necessary, unquote, for people to enjoy the public easement of a stream, as long as what people are doing is lawful and reasonable and not disruptive. Basically, the court said, as long as you're not being a jerk and you're obeying the law, you can fish and float and walk on private stream beds in public waters in Utah. That was until 2010.
It's important that we bring to a close the escalating confrontations between the property owners and the recreationalists.
This was the late Utah Senator Dennis Stoll introducing House Bill 141, also known as the Public Waters Access Act, on the Senate floor.
It does not accept the Knatzer expansion in 2008, which provides an easement on the land, but seeks to return to the pre-Knatzer relationship that existed between landowners and recreationalists.
Stoll's bill would make touching a private stream bed or bank illegal. It's important to know that when this bill came up, the session was in its final days. Lawmakers were scrambling to get things passed, and though a similar, more balanced bill had been discussed, many legislators expressed dismay with this last-minute surprise push to roll back the Knatzer decision. This was Senator Ross Romero.
Yeah, how long has the second substitute been available on the computer?
The second substitute has been available since about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock.
Okay, I guess I have some real concerns.
11:15.
Okay, 11:15. Some real concerns about us debating for passage of a bill that the public has only had until 11:15 today to review. It wasn't on our board for consideration to give the public even knowledge that it might be coming up. It hasn't been in its presented form until a few hours ago. And now we're talking about a bill, I'm assuming, for passage, because we're not just discussing it to discuss it, which I think has quite a few flaws.
This was Senator Brent Goodfellow.
Supposing that someone catches a fish. Sometimes those fish are pretty big, and sometimes you need to pull over in order to land that fish. That's against the law?
Yeah, you're in a boat, so you can land the fish in the boat.
But sometimes the boat continues to go, but the fish doesn't. So you have to pull over in order to let the fish fight, in order to pull the fish in. But you can't do that.
If the fish is attached with a fishing line, it'll usually follow you as you float.
Yet, the bill passed, and later Governor Herbert signed it into law. But not without some foretelling words of warning from other lawmakers. This was Senator John Valentine.
I am very concerned about the fact that once this bill does start get rolling, we will have passed the whole issue off to the courts. Unless we do as Senator Stoll has indicated, which is that we will spend some time this summer, have an inventory taken of some of our rivers, and we come back and make definitions next year before the effective date of this bill, this will have merely been a Band-Aid that would have then been torn off next year to a very open and festering wound that will not go away by the provisions of this bill.
This is when a coalition of fishers, floaters, birdwatchers, kayakers, and other recreationalists enter the story. The group called the Utah Stream Access Coalition formed to roll back the new law and reopen public access to Utah streams.
The one lesson that we've really learned is it's much easier to defeat a law before it becomes, or defeat a bill before it becomes law, than to try and overturn a law in the end.
This is Chris Olson, the coalition's president.
After this bill passed, House Bill 141, we were basically left with two legal options to try and overturn it. And one was to overturn the law entirely because it applied to non-navigable streams, or to see if the streams are navigable. And that's what we tried to do with the Weber case.
Olson's group set out to prove that the Weber River was navigable, or in other words, used for commerce, or susceptibly used for commerce, back in the 1890s when Utah became a state. Olson says they then hired a historian, Dr. Sarah Dant, at Weber State University to help them build a case.
Right up front, she said, you know, we're going to look for the facts in this, and we're going to look into the history, and the history might not be what you guys want, but we're going to go forward with it.
Dan's historical team spent hours probing microfilm and collections in places like the State Historical Society, BYU's Marriott Library, the LDS Church History Library. They scoured old journals, letters, family histories, and timber company records. Basically, any old documents that could show how the Weber River was used by early settlers in the 1890s.
Basically, if the river was used for commerce, if it was used for trade and travel at the time of statehood, or susceptible for use, and that's key, the susceptibility, then the river was navigable.
Olson says much of their case hinged on whether logs could be floated down the river.
I mean, you can think of any sort of commercial use or uses for commerce. So one of them was floating logs. You know, we had the railroads at this time of statehood. The railroads were coming in through Echo Canyon, and it's a really neat historical connection when you start looking at the Union Pacific and some of the other railroads that were going in at that time, and where those logs came from. You know, being cut at the headwaters of the Weber in the Uinta Mountains and then floated downstream to be pulled out and sawed. We also saw that there was, after the main log drive went through, then you would have cordwood for burning or for building. And then later, we saw that there was mining timbers that actually helped build the Park City mines.
Huh.
So it's really, really intertwined with Utah history, and it's one of the stories that really needed to be told, I think.
The landowners in the case were four private property owners along a short reach of the Weber River, above and below the Browns Canyon Bridge. Some of them had posted no trespassing signs and strung fencing across the river. For them, the issue is protecting their private property rights. Some are ranchers who worry about trespassers harassing their cows. Others worry about people damaging property or littering. Still, others fear public access could mean that anyone can walk across their property to reach a stream. Some fret that if the law allows more than just floating, but access to walk along stream beds too, it could open up every little creek bed, even the tiniest gullies running past people's backyards. Others have argued that public access would make landowners care less about protecting the health of a stream.
Yeah, we've heard those kind of arguments, and you know, you can flip that just the other way too and say, all right, well, what about the incentives for the public to fund mitigation when it's a high flood year and it tears out the side of your property? Or the public's obligation to stock the reservoirs, and most of these waters are tailwaters, so they flow into or out of a reservoir, to stock the reservoirs with fish that then swim up into the rivers. I mean, if there's non-native species there, then they were stocked there by the public at some point. Mm. So I think that's again where I come back to saying that, yeah, there's some certain rhetorical arguments.
After 5 days of trial, the Stream Access Coalition won the case. But the verdict allows public passage only through that 1 mile stretch through the four properties along the Weber. As of this recording, the landowners may still appeal the decision. And for now, the rest of the beds and banks of other parts of the Weber River remain closed. Still, later this summer, after more than 3 years of oral arguments and partial rulings, the coalition's other lawsuit on the constitutionality question is going to trial. This case focuses on the Provo River. Olson says they hope to quantify what has been lost.
What was really the scope of this bill when it was passed? And as we know it right now, it's about 47% of the rivers and streams in the state were just closed off.
In seeking a resolution, the Stream Access Coalition points to Idaho as a poster child. Idaho allows access to all of its public waters at or below the ordinary high water mark, except to get around obstructions. People fishing or boating or doing anything legal on the water can otherwise walk or touch private stream beds, as long as they just don't trespass across private land. Chris Olson acknowledges the conflict over this issue in Utah has been tense, to say the least. But he says,
I don't think it has to go on forever. I mean, if we look, you know, we were just talking about Idaho. It's worked there for nearly 40 years. Certainly Montana's had some stream access battles for the past 20 years, and New Mexico, unfortunately, just started down the road of their own set of stream access battles. They just did what we did in 2010 with their equivalent of House Bill 141 getting passed. But I think what the West kind of necessitates is a state that will find a good balance and be able to use that as a model. And I think Idaho's been instructive. Maybe it won't entirely work here in Utah, but I think we can really come to the table, find something in Utah that will balance these rights.
By October, the Utah Stream Access Coalition expects some final rulings on both of its lawsuits from the district court judges. And after that, they're hoping the legislature will be motivated to repeal HB 141 and reopen Utah's rivers and streams for all. For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
This land is your land, this land is mine. I hope that you notice the no trespassing sign.
We can't talk about recreation in Utah without talking about skiing. After the break, the best snow on earth versus Salt Lake City's drinking water. Stay tuned.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the College of Science at Utah State University. Public outreach information on the Facebook page Cache Valley Science Kids. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.
We can't talk about recreation in Utah without talking about skiing.
Well, if you want to be a skier, let me tell you what to do. You got to have time, like a month or two, and plenty of money, just a little bit more. And I don't mean hundreds, I mean figures of four, and a savings account. Rob the piggy bank.
I tend to forget about snow when I'm thinking about rivers and running water, but snow is arguably the most important form of water we have in Utah. It's the foundation for our watersheds. The marketing group Ski Utah released its end-of-season report this month. The season is measured in ski days, calculated by lift ticket sales in use, and the number was down from the average by 5%, which wasn't bad considering snowfall for the state's 14 ski resorts was 41% of average. The reason it wasn't a whole lot worse, according to Ski Utah spokesperson Paul Marshall, is because the resorts are able to make enough snow with machines to make up the difference.
In the year when we had a very low, unfortunate snowfall, and that's due to Mother Nature, investment in effective, energy-efficient snowmaking paid dividends into keeping skier visits and keeping our $1.3 billion winter industry economy alive.
And you need a mountain, preferably high, with a lodge and a pool that's right nearby, trails and runs and a good long tow, and something else? Oh yeah, snow. Plenty of it, brother. About 6 foot of base, little fresh powder every day. That's what they advertise.
So when you got There's no doubt that the state of Utah values the ski industry and the billion-plus dollars the greatest snow on earth brings. But tourists aren't really stakeholders in what we do with our mountains, and the money they bring is only part of the equation. That extra man-made snow that was needed to save the industry during this year's warm winter came at a cost. Snow falls from the sky, but it doesn't come out of nowhere. How can we be responsible stewards of the watershed and the landscape? What's the most environmentally friendly way of getting thousands of skiers to the slopes and back on any given powder day? How can we keep our reputation as life elevated and our thriving outdoor recreation economy without loving our backyard to death? These are big questions. This is a job for Mountain Accord. Mountain Accord is a group of over 20 private, nonprofit, and government organizations that sit at one big table trying to strike a balance between the environment, recreation, transportation, and the economy of the central Wasatch Mountains. They've been meeting for a while, and they're finally out with a proposed blueprint, a blueprint for the future, in light of a growing population, a changing climate, evolving technology, shifting values, and dwindling resources. Carl Fisher has one of the seats at the Mountain Accord table. He's the head of Save Our Canyons, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the wildness of the Wasatch Mountains.
The Mountain Accord was born out of conflict, really, as an effort to try and resolve conflict. Since about mid-90s, Save Our Canyons had been trying to expand upon the wilderness areas in the central Wasatch Mountains to try and protect some of the ecosystems, the wildlife habitat, and of course, our watershed.
What Carl Fisher would like to see most come out of Mountain Accord is permanent protection for the land. The current blueprint for the future includes federal protection at a couple of different levels. Fisher would be happy with any of them, he says, but the crown jewel would be protection under the Federal Wilderness Act.
It's one of the only ways we have to really permanently protect a landscape. The Wilderness Act is really iconic conservation legislation.
Well, any federal protection is better than no federal protection. Save Our Canyons favors something that allows for the kinds of recreation that tread lightly on the landscape and that won't threaten water quality.
I think recreation is important to our economy, to our quality of life. But there are those out there who think that recreation should be the driving factor for land management. I believe more that conservation should be the driving factor and that we make allowances for recreation, but that not be the driver.
One of the reasons it's so important to protect the Central Wasatch Mountains is because 350,000 people rely on that snow for their drinking water. Laura Briefer also has a seat at the Mountain Accord table. She's the water resource manager for Salt Lake City Public Utilities. Knowing what she knows about where the city's drinking water comes from should make you think twice about what happens in the mountains.
What'll we do when the snow's all gone? What'll we do when the grass turns green? What'll we do when the toes shut down and our favorite run is a muddy ravine? What'll we do when it doesn't snow?
Salt Lake City's watershed is really in your face. Anytime you gaze out at the peaks of the Central Wasatch, you're essentially looking at the water that will someday be coming out of your tap, right?
Right. So Salt Lake City gets the majority of its culinary water or drinking water from the Central Wasatch Mountains. And that includes the streams from City Creek, Parley's Canyon, Big Cottonwood Canyon, Little Cottonwood Canyon, and then we also have some storage rights along the Provo River system in the Deer Creek and Jordanelle system. Really, we could say that on average, Salt Lake City and the citizens that rely on the drinking water that Salt Lake City provides gets about 90% of its water supply from surface water emanating from the Central Wasatch.
Those canyons that you mentioned are probably less known as sources for culinary water than they are for a home to some pretty famous ski resorts.
That's right. So our municipal, we refer to our watersheds where we receive our drinking water as our municipal watersheds. And that's because there are some regulatory requirements related to our municipal watersheds. Our two most important municipal watersheds, Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons, are home to four world-class ski resorts, Alta, Brighton, Snowbird, and Solitude. And they also host a growing population of dispersed recreation users, so people that like to backcountry ski outside of resort boundaries, people that like to rock climb and hike and mountain bike. In fact, the area of the Central Wasatch is in the top five most heavily used national forests for recreation in the country and receives just about as much visitation as Yellowstone National Park, and it's pretty much all recreation.
And what impact do those recreational activities have on the watershed?
Well, you know, our concern is loving the environment to death. So, you know, a healthy, functioning watershed is important for good water quality and for a reliable supply. And as we recreate in these watersheds, we could love the watersheds to death. We could provide a risk to the healthy functioning of those watersheds if it's not managed correctly. So, you know, a lot of the way to mitigate a lot of the recreational use is to do things like manage impacts, whether those are trail impacts, whether we need to put restrooms in place or sanitary facilities in place so that we don't, you know, have human waste impacting our streams. The side effect, too, of a lot of commercial recreation is this pressure to develop more within the watershed, so more buildings and more homes and those types of things. So we have a lot of associated pressure from that, which in turn impacts that functioning of our municipal watersheds.
How is Salt Lake City Public Utilities planning for the future? I mean, there are plans in other parts of the state to develop new sources of water, like pipelines on the Bear River or the Lake Powell pipeline. But what are the options for Salt Lake City? I mean, is the water that's coming out of the local mountains the only source of water that the city has or will ever have in the future?
It's sort of an interesting question, because what we do is as a water supply entity, as a municipal water supplier, you know, we plan for 100 years of, you know, population growth and for increased water needs. So when we do these plans, we do identify additional sources, but those sources that we identify are just incrementally a little bit more. And really the base and the most important part of our drinking water system is the water that comes off the Wasatch Mountains. If we lose that, we really don't have other options. It would be very difficult to serve our community, if not impossible. The other great thing about the Central Wasatch in terms of reliability of the water supply is the fact that Salt Lake City holds the majority of the water rights to those systems. So we don't have the same kind of conflict over the right to use water that other systems might, where it's in a much more shared environment amongst different entities. And so that's another reason why this is so important to us. It was the first source of water for Salt Lake City. And as the city has grown, we've expanded those resources. It is still the basis of the economy and public health of our community.
There's a proposed blueprint out right now from the Mountain Accord. It just went through a public comment period, and I know that it can still change at this point. But with what's being proposed right now, do you think that it includes adequate protection for the watershed?
I think it does. And the reason why it addresses watershed protection is that it allows for protection of thousands of acres of land, either in a federal designation that is an enhanced protective designation on federal lands that exist in our watersheds, and it also seeks to protect some private land in holdings from development. The other thing that the Mountain Accord blueprint does is it, and it's a little ambiguous right now, but one of the goals is to provide resources to collaboratively manage our watersheds in terms of land use and recreational impacts. And so from that standpoint, I think that the blueprint really is a great opportunity for us to have certainty with respect to the long-term protection of those watersheds. There are ongoing negotiations with respect to the ski resorts, and part of that negotiation has a nexus to water. And for instance, each of the ski resorts would like to increase snowmaking. The way that they do snowmaking at the resorts is through a surplus water contract with Salt Lake City. Since Salt Lake City holds the water rights, you know, we're not allowed to divest of those water rights, because those water rights are for the economic prosperity and the public health of our community down in the valley. That said, we recognize that there is a benefit, a quality of life benefit, and an economic benefit to supporting our ski resorts. So we enter into a contract situation with each ski resort that allows them to use some water for snowmaking. And, you know, what they're asking for is increased snowmaking water to ensure their sustainability over time. So we're willing to work with them on that in exchange for certainty that we're not going to have additional ski area expansion into the watersheds, or certainty that we have additional land protection in perpetuity.
Is there surplus water? I guess I don't understand the definition of surplus water. Maybe you could explain that.
Right.
Yeah, is there surplus to give?
It's kind of a funny term. So what you have to do is understand the hydrologic cycle of our watersheds. And so snowmelt happens, and we have a peak in flows from our watersheds, and then over the summer, the flows go down. And so during the winter, when the resorts are making water, that's when we have a low demand period in our system. And so we're able to say, you know, during the month of November, we've entered into a contract where they can use a certain amount of water for snowmaking. They're using it when we don't have high demand for water. because people aren't watering outdoors.
I know that Salt Lake City Utilities has been really proactive about planning for climate change. Does the Mountain Accord blueprint address climate change, or does it take it into consideration at all?
Mountain Accord does address climate change. So over the last year, as we were developing information that establishes our baseline conditions in the mountains and our anticipated future trend lines, we used a lot of data collected with respect to climate change vulnerabilities and impacts across the region. We've also looked at it from the perspective of, you know, the root of the problem, greenhouse gas emissions. One of the goals of Mountain Accord is to evaluate, you know, as part of the criteria, do the actions reduce greenhouse gas emissions potentially, or would they increase them, or, you know, how would that effect on the greenhouse gas emission side as well. As we move forward into the next phase, I would like to see climate change be more rigorously evaluated. So, for instance, if we move forward into an environmental review process under the National Environmental Policy Act, I hope that we have a section in there that looks at climate change in terms of climate change in water or in terms of greenhouse gases or snowpack even.
Mountain Accord is a huge undertaking. It's a huge conversation. There are like 200 people at the table. The public is involved. There are organizations there that don't really get along. Carl Fisher from Save Our Canyon said, you know, that the Mountain Accord was born out of conflict. What's it like to be a part of that? I mean, either like personally or representing Salt Lake City Public Utilities?
That is a great question. It is a very intense process for the reasons you mentioned. I'd like to step back a little bit to talk about what originally brought us to the table. And for Salt Lake City and for, you know, our Department of Public Utilities in particular, what we've seen over the years is this propensity within the Central Wasatch to make piecemeal decisions. So, you know, what we felt is that the status quo of just this increasing pressure and lots of jurisdictions involved in piecemeal decision making probably wasn't the best for the future of our watersheds. And if there's an opportunity to just sit down with all of the interests and negotiate a more certain future for the Wasatch that does the things that we want the Wasatch to do for us, in terms of water, in terms of recreation, but primarily the protection of this amazing natural system and resource. We wanted to be there at that table, and we wanted to be a leader at the table. And so to your question with respect to what is it like, I have to say that I have been extremely impressed at the collaboration across interests, how much each of the interests at the table have been willing to dig deeply and talk about what is really driving their wants and needs for the Wasatch. And I think that's brought us even now to a much better place than we were before we started Mountain Accord. It is a hard process. I won't lie. It is on a day-to-day basis, can be very challenging, but I'm really glad that we're doing it.
In this white world reaches the sky, I've found a future for me.
Laura Briefer. She's the Water Resource Manager for Salt Lake City Public Utilities and a very busy participant of the Mountain Accord process. She'll be heavily involved in phase two of the process, which is the environmental review period. A bunch of federal agencies will be looking at the blueprint, which includes increased federal protection of public land, which Carl Fisher is asking for. That could be under the Wilderness Act, or parts of the Central Wasatch could become a national monument or a national recreation area. The blueprint calls for over 2,000 acres of public land surrounding the ski resorts. And in return, the resorts would get public transportation, so that could be a rail line, it might be a rapid bus system, they're not really sure yet. And they'll also get permission to develop around those new bus or train stops, and they'll get some additional water for snowmaking from, presumably, Salt Lake Public Utilities. And it will be a couple of years before the environmental review period is over and any of these plans go into effect.
For Iskies are the things that give him his wings and make him an eagle on high.
The Source comes from the studios of Utah Public Radio with major support from iUtah. Ryan Cunningham produces a lot of the show. He makes everyone sound smart and articulate and nips my long-windedness in the bud. Megan Semper wrote and played our theme music. Catch her live with her band Hoodoo on June 20th at the Mendon Mountain Music Festival in the little town of Mendon in Cache Valley, Utah. Special thanks to Source reporter Ross Chambliss and all of our guests. You can listen to previous episodes of The Source at upr.org while you wait for the next month's show to come out. Follow Utah Public Radio on Facebook and Twitter. The hashtag for the show is UPR Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Thank you for listening.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn how an area now occupied by an oil refinery, a gravel mine, and a freeway was once Salt Lake's premier tourist attraction. First this.
I'm Cynthia Buckingham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. Everyone smells it, a whiff of sulfur as your car rounds the corner on I-15 between Salt Lake and Davis counties. Nowadays, the smell of stagnant pools of mineral water might be considered an insult to the senses, but in the late 1800s, these hot springs attracted locals and tourists alike. Thermal hot springs are common in the Great Basin, and those in Salt Lake Valley were noticed by early pioneers. Orson Pratt noted in July 1847 the great number of hot springs, heavy with salt and sulfur and boiling temperatures. Just 4 miles north of Salt Lake City was the largest of these, the Wasatch Warm Springs and the nearby Hot Springs Lake. The new settlers frequently bathed there and by 1850 had built swimming pools, a dining room, and a dance hall. Warm Springs became a popular camping spot for people traveling into the city, and by 1865, mule trains brought residents to the baths. Many people thought mineral springs provided extraordinary cures. In an 1871 tourist guide, the Transcontinental Railroad promoted Warm Springs for its healing waters, and travelers soon detoured there for the health benefits. In 1885, a resort called Beck's Hot Springs was built adjacent to Warm Springs and became known as the Sanitarium of the West. An 1886 newspaper article hailed the waters as having healing benefits for dyspepsia, diabetes, and skin disease. The article quoted a Mrs. Barnes from the eastern United States who claimed to be cured from her chronic rheumatism after visiting Beck's Hot Springs. To accommodate tourists, hotels and pools were built and a dedicated railroad line made regular trips to the hot springs. But by the 1930s, demand for the healing waters faded and the resorts eventually closed, ironically, for health reasons. So the next time you smell that sulfur, remember, it is a remnant of Utah's fountain of youth. This episode of the Beehive Archive was contributed by Heidi Orchard. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University.